Good morning, everyone.
Good morning.
Maybe at the beginning or end of this next walk, you could just have a little bit of stretching in place, since we're not doing the yoga this morning. Sometimes as the morning wears on, things get stiff.
I was curious about the temperature too. Crack the windows a little bit. Is the temperature good or too?
Good.
Okay.
Thank you. Air is good.
Yeah. Okay.
So. One of Joan's phrases is where I want to start. Speaking of Siddhartha, born into a world endlessly imagining itself into existence. Born into a world endlessly imagining itself into existence. And I'd like to invite us to stop for a moment and just feel that, just be it, just do it. A world endlessly imagining itself into existence. So what world might that be? And in whose imagination? And whose is the world's imagination? Who is this world? So Siddhartha, Shakyamuni Buddha, is sometimes called, had a life and taught. And 400 years later, words that had been passed down orally were written in Pali and Sanskrit, neither of which was Siddhartha Gautama's language. And one koan in particular has been speaking to me this morning. It's the one that says roughly, the Buddha Dharma is so straight. Why do all the ancestors sing such a crooked song? Another way to say this might be, since there is only ever one thing to say, why do we have all these books and conversations and websites and webinars and poems, films, paintings, stupas, and silly Dharma talks? So hold that question for a moment, and we'll go back to this particular Buddha body of Siddhartha. He's raised in the palace. He's schooled in the arts of governing and war. And fortunately for us, he doesn't get the curiosity whipped out of him. Did not go to a public school. And at 29, he slips out of there, slips out of that protected spot. And his friend and charioteer takes him, and he sees a sick person and is told, you too will be sick. And sees someone aged and is told, you too will be old like that. Sees a corpse, you too will be like that. and sees a sage, someone sitting in peace, in equanimity, in the middle of all of that. And he's pretty much, I want some of what he's got, and leaves to go find it. Learns about suffering. Gets more and more and more determined and appalled by it, we could say. And as you know, practices more and more severe austerities with his five companions in the end, trying to starve the heck out of this beast. And so then we come to this lovely story that Nicole referred to last night, which comes out of Colosso's book Ka, I believe. So I want to read it to you. Many years later, Siddhartha has been practicing such extreme austerities that he's on the brink of death. Sitting in the forest, he faints with hunger. When he comes to, he's alone and disheartened. But suddenly, he remembers something from his childhood. He's lying under a rose apple tree looking around. For the moment, everyone has forgotten about him. He feels no resistance to what he sees. No resistance. No sense that anything is lacking. There's nothing he wants other than exactly what is happening. He wonders, Siddhartha, why this image should appear now, and whether that early memory of ease, rather than the harsh discipline he's been practicing, is the way to freedom. Are you afraid of this happiness? He startles himself by asking. The answer is no, but he's too weak to do anything about it. So that is some potent imagining. But seeing it is not enough. Meantime, in a nearby town, a woman named Sujata falls asleep and has a dream. Because of the dream, she goes out to her family's herd and milks 1,000 cows, feeding their milk to 500 cows and so on down to the last few cows. She mixes this rich milk with rice, puts it in a golden bowl, and walks out into the forest. So here is her potent imagining. She follows it completely. It's a lot of milking, don't you think? She has no idea what she'll find, which turns out to be Siddhartha sitting under a tree, just awakened from his faint. Though he's weak, already there's a muted glow about him. She offers him her bowl of milk and rice, saying, "May this bring you as much joy to eat as it brought me to make." She must be going, "Well, at least I found somebody." Siddhartha eats, and Sujata's blessing flows over the harsh landscape of his austerities. In that spot by the river, a meeting, a blessing to each other. And so he takes a step towards life, for one thing, but also toward trusting what comes to meet him with openness, discovering that life invites, and that we could actually accept the invitation. In a way, it seems that he's finally too weak to resist it. And I think we know that experience too, yeah? The moment when we're finally too weak to resist the invitation that we otherwise might have turned aside. It happened that it was Sujata who met him and that he accepted that invitation, even though his five best buddies were horrified by it, right? They're out of there. You ate. And so he goes and sits in the shelter of a tree, his last teacher. He's done so much work on this problem. He studied from all the masters of the time, but he has not yet sat at the feet of his master. So last night I read you, and I'm going to repeat it, in the Dhammapada, an anthology of Buddha's sayings, he's said to have declared, "House builder, you've been seen through, you're seen through, you'll never again build another house. Your rafters are broken, the ridgepole knocked down, all has returned to the unformed, all has returned to the unformed. The mind has come to an end of craving." And I'm pretty sure when I first read that, that happened during the night, actually. That was not after he saw the star. So I think there's this, to me it's an image of that deep, deep open darkness, the big, spacious darkness, in which he can see that. And so this is the next very particular meeting. He's met the builder of his house of pain, and the light of his mind has shone right through all the pieces of it. Tear down the rafters, carpenter, right? What is it? Tear down the... Somebody must know that exact phrase. Roof beams, carpenter. Such a celebration, such a wild thing. And he meets a star. He meets this very particular one. We can't even know the name of this star. It's got to be Venus, right? But that we don't know the name of his own particular star. And it has its own name for him, I think. We don't know the name that the star calls him either. But what seems to happen here is that the star shines through that house, through all the pieces, through Siddhartha himself, and is in turn lit by him. This is a thorough interpermeation of the light. A particular meeting. And then there's another step. He notices something. And writing much later, the Zen tradition gives Gautama these words. How wonderful. I and all beings have awakened together. So, and Ehe Dogen's words are not that different, yeah? When the morning star appeared, I and the sentient beings of earth simultaneously attained enlightenment. All of us just woke up. So earlier I asked you to do an imagining of the field that we create together and out of which we emerge moment by moment by moment, the field that is us. And I don't know whether you could feel it. There's a yes. That everything that is right here, everything that is happening, everything that you smell and hear and taste and see, is the co-creation of our imagining. And we are imagined by it. When you stand up, everything stands up. When everything stands up, you stand up. And so, at that moment, at that time, with that realization, he became radiant. And the story says that the first sage that met him on the road said, "You're shining." And so here again was shining into and being shown into, yeah? Being seeing and being seen, lighting and being lit. And that particular thing, I think, had to happen next, because I and all beings are awakened at this moment can feel a little abstract. It's a reach, right? It's in the realm of the vastness, but it wants a particular meaning. It wants a name for it to be realized, to have power in this life, in this place. So he becomes radiant. Star seer becomes a star. And just as his radiance is a result of that particular meeting, he realizes that each meeting is its own expression of this. So I want to come back to the Buddha Dharma is so straight. Why do all the ancestors sing such a crooked song? And it's connected a little bit in my mind with the koan most of you, many of you have heard, that says walk straight, yeah, on a narrow mountain path with 99 turns. Mm-hmm. So, the Dharma is always walking straight, but it has nothing to stand on unless it's at this particular turn. There is no other road, right? There is no other straight road except this little one you're facing, you're in right now. And so, if the Buddha had just sort of tried to give a general teaching that would stay still and be pinned down for all time, he would have already missed it, wouldn't he? Because he would be denying the very thing that was the root and impulse and expression of his own awakening, a particular meeting. So there is no other meeting but a particular meeting. There is no other us but us in this room. There isn't any other field of awakening. So we get to keep on singing this crooked tune with each other and to each other, in all the ins and outs of what we're going through, because this is where the power lies. If we wish to meet what is coming to meet us, if we think we can sing the one song that will cover everything, we've already missed it, haven't we? There's only the meetings that we can have. And that's the co-creation of our awakening, and of the awakening that we bring to this world and that we receive from this world, this very one, full of exactly the stuff this one is full of right now. the particular meetings.